All right, good morning, everyone. At least everyone that's here. Most everybody's here now. So, if you're following along in our on the list of topics, we're looking at topic 13 today. I'm going to talk about tribal jurisdiction over non-members, the adjudicatory cases. So, the last time we talked about the regulatory cases, which were have to do with tribes' ability to regulate non-member activities. And now we're going to talk about the jurisdiction of tribal courts themselves. And a key principle is that the scope of tribal powers under both regulatory jurisdiction and adjudicatory jurisdiction is basically the same. So if you read the cases, you'll probably come across some language that say, the scope of tribal regulatory jurisdiction is no more than its adjudicatory jurisdiction and vice versa. So just get that out of the way. There are reasons why the court keeps bringing this up that I think are not very important, but if you have a question about it, let me know. It does come up quite a bit in the Hicks case, and we'll get to that shortly. But before we get started with today's material, I would love to hear any questions you have so far from yesterday about the class, anything you want to ask. Now's a good time. Anytime's a good time, but now is especially a good time. All right. That's an idea. I have no t-shirts available. $5. Well, that's just my fee for designing the t-shirt. You don't actually get the t-shirt for that. You know, my favorite t-shirt that I've seen this week is from a company in Iowa called Raygun. Google it sometime, and they have a great t-shirt that they've been advertising this week, which is, I think, a reference to that movie from about 15, 20 years ago called America Team Police, America or America Team Police, which is done by the South Park guys. And it's a musical, and there's a song in that movie called America Fuck Yeah. And basically it's just America. The lyrics are America Fuck Yeah, coming to save the motherfucking world or something like that. Anyway, so they have that phrase America Fuck Yeah in the t-shirt, and they just cross out yeah. It's just America Fuck. That's the t-shirt I would go with, but all right. Any other questions? I'm sorry, there's no t-shirts available. That's an idea. Maybe next time. We'll keep that in mind. Okay. Seeing no questions, which is fine. We will, let's start with topic 13. So the first case we're going to talk about is called Straight versus A1 Contractors. And this is a case involving a car accident on the Fort Berthold Reservation, which is the tribe there is known as currently known as the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Nation. But that's relatively new. Back in the 90s, it was known as, and before that, it was known as the Three Affiliated Tribes. So we call it another MHA Nation. In any event, this is in western North Dakota. So the reservation has a highway that bisects the reservation east to west, and some other places too, but that's our key highway for today. And the fact pattern involved a car wreck in which A1 Contractor's truck, which is was doing some work at the tribal government complex, some landscaping work, so it's a contractor, driving on the road on a highway that is maintained by the state of North Dakota, gets into a car accident with a woman named Gisela Fredericks. She's not Indian. She's not a member of the tribe, but she lives on trust land on the reservation. She has been married to a tribal member since World War II. In fact, she is a World War II war bride. All of her relatives are tribal citizens, her kids, her husband, and I'm not sure if he was still alive when this case was ongoing. And she really had never lived anywhere in the U.S. except this trust land. The fact pattern is not clear. There's sort of a running theme to a lot of these cases you will see on the adjudicatory jurisdiction aspect, is that they never reached the merits at the tribal court level. And this is important because when they do reach the merits, you actually know what the facts of the case are. And as you know, when you have a motion to dismiss on jurisdictional grounds or a motion for summary judgment, the parties often stipulate to the facts, or more usually, actually in this context, the court has to take into consideration the facts as alleged by the plaintiff. So it's not entirely clear, because there was never a hearing in this case, whether the accident occurred on the highway or actually on the trust land, because Ms. Fredericks was turning her car onto her trust allotment. And when she was hit. So you can imagine, I mean, it probably was on the highway because that's where the truck was. But, you know, if the truck was off the highway because it was driving recklessly or erratically or negligently, then maybe it was on the trust allotment. In any event, the court found assumed as a matter of law that the accident occurred on the state highway. Now, the court held as a matter of law that a state highway is not Indian land, non-Indian land, for purposes of tribal jurisdiction. So just Gisela Fredericks brought a claim, or actually her family and her brought a claim in tribal court against A1 Contractors. Incidentally, Straight was the name of the tribal judge when we get into federal court. And I'll have to explain all of these issues relating to exhaustion here in a minute, too, but we'll get to that in a second. So you have Fredericks versus A1 Contractors in tribal court. Tribal court doesn't actually hear any parts of this case. The A1 Contractors immediately brings a federal court action in the District of North Dakota to enjoin the tribal court action, and that's successful, and they prevail at the Eighth Circuit as well, the non-members. And we get to the Supreme Court. The case is captioned Straight versus A1 Contractors. Straight is the tribal judge. Really, it's the tribe. And really, it's Fredericks, the individual plaintiffs to the case, as the real party in interest, so to speak. So what happens when somebody sues a non-member in tribal court? There's a couple of different options for the non-member, several different options. The first time this really became a huge issue was in the mid-80s. A school district on the Crow Reservation was sued by a kid who got into an accident on school district property within the Crow Reservation. So the first option, they sued the school district, the first option is just to ignore the lawsuit because it's your school district and you don't care what a tribal court says about you. Now, that case became a Supreme Court case in 1985 called National Farmers Union Insurance Company versus Crow Tribe of Indians. How it became known as National Farmers Union Insurance Company is because the school district principal or superintendent, whomever, received the initial notice of complaint and summons from the tribal court, ignored it. And then when they got a default judgment against the school district, that's when they called the insurance company. And the insurance company brought a claim that ultimately would be captioned National Farmers Union Insurance Company versus Crow Tribe. In any event, the court in 1985 held that non-members who are sued in tribal court must exhaust their tribal remedies. And this is a absolutely critical doctrine that kind of dominates tribal civil adjudication questions and even regulatory questions. If you have a claim, even under Topic 12, to challenge, a tribal ordinance, you still have to bring a claim against the tribe in tribal court. We'll set that aside for a moment and talk about adjudicatory jurisdiction. If you're a non-member suit in tribal court, you have to exhaust your tribal remedies before you can go to federal court. So the 85 decision of National Farmers Union also says that once you do exhaust your tribal remedies, you have Effectively, the court acknowledged that there is a right of non-members to be free of tribal jurisdiction, and that you can go to federal court to effectuate that right. So they created a federal right as a matter of federal common law, and they created a cause of action and opened up the federal courthouse doors also as a matter of federal common law. Now, keep in mind, 7 years earlier, before National Farmers Union, the Supreme Court was loath to create implied or federal common law causes of action to authorize non-members or anybody to bring a claim under the Indian Civil Rights Act. But for whatever reason, in National Farmers Union, they reached a largely opposite conclusion to say that non-members have the right to bring a claim in federal court to challenge a tribal court's exercise of jurisdiction over them, so long as they exhaust their tribal remedies. So that's a tribal exhaustion doctrine. Now, let's go back to the Strait case. Remember what I told you in 85, National Farmers Union requires exhaustion. And then there was a case in 87 that said you have to exhaust your remedies all the way through whatever tribal appellate processes there are as well. By the way, that case is called Iowa Mutual Insurance Company versus LaPlante. So in this case, in Strait, however, the A1 contractors went directly to federal court, and the federal court said, yeah, we'll let you go ahead and you don't have to exhaust your remedies. Same with the Eighth Circuit. You don't have to exhaust your federal remedies. Your tribal remedies. And those decisions are not particularly well considered because they don't make any sense. Just exhaust your remedies. Litigate in tribal court. You might even win. Maybe Gisela Fredericks was at fault and you win on the merits. But nonetheless, they excused the exhaustion requirement. When we get to the Supreme Court, the court in a footnote also excuses the exhaustion requirement and creates an exception. It acknowledges an exception to the exhaustion requirement, which is effectively, if there was never plausible or colorable jurisdiction in the tribal court, then you don't have to exhaust your remedies. And they don't say exactly what that means. Nobody really knows what that means. The lower courts have, especially in the Ninth Circuit, have created a whole body of law about what colorable or plausible tribal jurisdiction is. And all it does is means that you have to go to tribal court and exhaust your remedies. But the Supreme Court had this case in front of it, could have just said you need to exhaust your tribal remedies, but they chose to allow the non-members to litigate the case on the jurisdictional merits, but not the factual merits, because they were going to dismiss it anyway. So the court ruled 9-0 that the tribe did not have jurisdiction over this claim. The tribal court did not have jurisdiction. So what they ruled first was that the case arose on non-Indian land, non-member-owned land, and that's because it's a state highway. It is still within the reservation, and actually the land upon which the highway rests is trust land owned by the United States and for the benefit of the tribe. So actually it is Indian land. But the court said that the federal statute that created the authorization for the tribe and or the United States to grant easements to state governments for highway purposes, rights of way, easements, whatever those might be, for Indian law purposes only, changes the status of the land from Indian owned to non-Indian owned for purposes of Indian law. Which is if you're a property professor, none of that makes any damn sense whatsoever. And this is not really a part of the case, but my way of rationalizing, even though I hate it, the outcome in Hicks is that federal statute, once invoked by the tribe and or the United States to the benefit of a state, does strip a tribe of presumptive jurisdiction over even reservation or trust land. And I think that if the court had made that more explicit than it did in its opinion, the case would be a little bit more palatable, easier to swallow. Let's just take a step back. What we look for in terms of the divestiture of tribal powers is an act of Congress and or agreement by the tribe to strip the tribe of jurisdiction. And in this case, the tribe is actually the one that agreed to the easement, the grant of the right of the way to the state. And there was a federal statute that authorized it. So I think even both of those things, at least implicitly, are present in this case. Now, one question we got is it the same for the right of way of private right of way for rail companies? No, I don't think so. I think it actually has to be the case is relevant here because it's a state. It becomes state land. The problem with railway companies are separate because there is a whole body of federal law that grants a lot of liability immunities to railway companies and diverts a lot of those cases into federal court. So you will see a lot of lower appellate court opinions on railways in Indian Country at Crow and Blackfeet and elsewhere that say that tribes don't have jurisdiction. They just follow the Montana test. But really what they could do is say this is really a railroad and these cases should be diverted to federal court where, you know, they'll get dismissed because railroads have a lot of immunities in federal court and the restrictions on liability and that sort of thing that Congress has granted them. And that's not really fair, but that's just the way it goes. Okay, so coming back to the straight opinion, the court says this is non-Indian land or non-tribal land for our purposes of civil jurisdiction. Therefore, the Montana test applies. And this is an important ruling because it confirms what the court had been sort of the way they had been acting throughout the 80s, but not actually explicitly saying, which is when you're on non-Indian land, the Montana test applies. When you're on tribal lands, as in Marion and Mescalero, the Montana test doesn't apply. And so the court goes to great lengths to effectively rewrite property law to make it so that we're on this, even though it's on an easement, to make it so that we're on non-Indian land. And then the court applies the Montana test. The second part of the opinion that's hard to swallow, I guess you could say, and an extremely callous, let's just be right out. This is a morbid analysis. When the court does engage in the Montana analysis, it really goes out of its way to do everything it can to find neither exception implies. So in the first instance with Montana 1, the Fredericks, and I guess the tribe, argue that the only reason A1 Contractors is on the reservation is because they have a contract to do business with the tribe. They're a landscaping company that is agreed to comply with tribal jurisdiction for questions arising out of the contract. And the court says there's no nexus between that landscaping contract and the accident that occurred. First of all, contract is different than tort. And the contract claim that arises under a contract at the on the landscaping job is totally different of a different theory, I guess you could say, than the one in tort, which is the one Fredericks brought. They're miles away from each other, so there's a physical difference. And so there's just no connection between the Montana 1 type consent arising from the landscaping deal, the landscaping project, and the tort that occurred on the reservation because the truck is on the reservation due to the landscaping deal. The link was too attenuated for the court. So that's a pretty strained reasoning of the Montana 1 exception, and it really restricts what types of consents actually work in the context of consenting to tribal jurisdiction. So there's that. The second one, this is what I'm really talking about in terms of a morbid analysis, is the Montana 2 analysis. So Fredericks and the tribe argue that, you know, you've got somebody hit by a non-member on the reservation by a truck. And there were a bunch of lower court cases pending at the time involving railroads and other, you know, big, long-haul, large commercial transportation vehicles hitting truckloads of Indians and killing and maiming a whole bunch of people. And a lot of those cases were pending in tribal courts around the country at the time. So the court said that the Montana 2 test is more than just Pi's HW. Those things are the hooks, but the impact on the tribe must be so consequential as to imperil the very existence of the tribe. So running a bunch of Indians over on the road isn't going to imperil the existence of the tribe. The tribe will continue. And then the court said also, and this, the tribe is a stranger to this case because Gisela Fredericks is not even a tribal member. You know, this case could have been brought in state court. The court notes that the state court that probably would have handled this case is even closer to the accident than the tribal court, which is all the way across the reservation. Why it said that is completely irrelevant, of course. But, it, you know, they're, I suspect that, you know, when it comes to Indian law and, you know, you assign an opinion to somebody as prominent as RBG, she's going to be focusing on other cases rather than what happens in an Indian law case. In any event, shortly after this opinion came down, the Ninth Circuit issued an opinion in a case called Wilson versus Marchington, which was the exact same fact pattern. But instead of the plaintiff, the victim being a non-member, it was a tribal member. And the Ninth Circuit explicitly said, you know, tort claims against one or even a small group of Indian people is not enough to invoke the Montana 2 test. So ever since that time, when somebody invokes Montana 2, you engage in this morbid analysis. How many Indians does it take to kill off a tribe? And it's a lot. So Alex has a great question. I was thinking about it even while I was saying this a minute ago. When I lived in California, by the way, in Hoopa, the tribal chairman there at that time was negotiating these gaming compact things in California. And in California, they have revenue sharing between the tribes and the state, but also between the tribes and each other. So a lot of the tribes like Hoopa don't actually have profitable gaming operations. So they step back and let other tribes run the big gaming facilities, and they take a percentage of that as, you know, not a much, like $1 million a year of just free money. And the chairman from Hoopa, my boss, was telling me that there was a tribe at that time in California that had three tribal members, two adults and one infant baby. And the two adults were both in prison. So you can imagine the accident to a tribe that small, I guess, could implicate the tribe's continuing viability. I don't know, but that's all I'm saying is that it's a particularly morbid and awful analysis to undertake. But that's where the court is. There's a bit of a backstory. I know you guys like sipping tea, and I have a theory about what happened with Strait. So the case is captioned Strait versus A1 Contractors, and if you go and look and for the past 50 years, and you can do this on Turtle Talk. We have a page on there with the list of all the Supreme Court opinions. So if you go back to basically to the 1950s, we don't go back that far, but for the past 30 or 40 years, you will find that the petitioner in these cases almost always is the non-tribal interest. So it's the United States, it's a state, A1 Contractors, although they're, in this case, they are the respondent. What that means is if a tribe wins below, the court is likely to grant review of that case, more so than if the tribe lost below. And it's as if the court thinks, and I've been told by clerks informally, former Supreme Court clerks, that tribes aren't supposed to win. They're like habeas petitioners, prisoners, immigrants. They're not supposed to win below. And so when they do, the court takes an especially searching look at that opinion and is more likely to grant it. Now, when tribes lose below or Indians, that's what's supposed to happen. And they almost never grant certiorari in those cases. This case is an exception. It's Strait versus A1 Contractors. It's the tribal judge versus A1 Contractors. So the tribal interest lost below and they granted review of the case. Now, here's why I think they granted review. Because it was the first time a federal appellate court, at least since the Montana case, had held that a tribe didn't have jurisdiction over non-members for something that arose on Indian land, on trust land. And I think they took the case to sort of do the bookend to the Montana case, which is, you know, when you're on non-Indian land, you apply the Montana test, and the general rule is no, tribes don't have jurisdiction. I suspect that they took this case because they thought the Eighth Circuit got it really, really wrong. And but you still have a 9-0 decision against the tribal interest, and the question is why? Here's why I think is why. Do you remember when I said that there are a lot of cases pending against big commercial transportation companies like railroads? So there was an amicus brief filed at the Supreme Court. And if you know anything about Supreme Court practice, there are always amicus briefs filed in every Supreme Court case. Anywhere from 1 to 350 or 500 cases are briefs. In Indian law cases, it tends to be between 5 and 10 amicus briefs that are filed. And so you'll in the 90s, when things were a little bit out of control with tribal representation, it would be like 3 or 4 briefs from various conglomerates of tribes, all saying the same thing. Tribes should always win every single time the Supreme Court would be those briefs. And then there would be briefs on the other side, usually a brief from states that are interested that want to say to assert state interests, and then commercial interests against tribal interests, that sort of thing. So the brief that was filed on behalf of commercial interests were filed by insurance companies and railroad companies and banks that were being sued in tribal court. And the railroad the brief opens with a recitation of facts from a case called Red Wolf versus Burlington Northern, which had been filed in Crow Tribal Court. And if you read the brief, you will find no citations whatsoever to the record. But basically, it says that when the Red Wolf clan was hit and run by a train, a whole bunch of people were injured, and they brought a claim against the railroad company. They had a trial. They went to a trial on the merits. And at the conclusion of, according to the railroad, at the conclusion of the trial, before the jury was dismissed for deliberation purposes, a judge not from the case, but another tribal judge walked in the courtroom and asked to speak to the jury, and was given permission to speak separately to the jury. And in the Absalike language, again, according to the railroad company, and in the Absalike language, said, "These railroad companies have been screwing over our tribe and our people for centuries. This is your chance to get back at them." And they did. They came back with a judgment for many, many millions of dollars against the railroad company, which was probably perfectly justified given the railroad company's negligence and the horrific damages that, you know, deaths and maiming and dismemberment that occurred to the victims. If that's true, that is a terrible violation of due process. And well, if it does happen in a tribal court, you're the non-member who feels like that's happened to you, you file an appeal and you get the judgment vacated. But if you're a non-member and you got a lot of money, forget about going to the appellate level. You go directly to federal court and complain about how awful the tribal court was. You don't bother seeking relief within the tribal processes. And because of the timing of that case and the timing of the Strait case, what the railroad company did was say, we filed this thing in federal district court, and we're not going to go to the Crow Tribal Court of Appeals or the Crow Supreme Court or whatever it was called, and complain about it also in the appellate in an amicus brief. Again, no citations to the record. I have no idea how the railroad company's attorneys knew what was being said, even if any of this happened. It's a part of me that thinks it's wildly exaggerated what had happened. I have no idea. I don't speak Absalike. No, and none of the people who were bitching about this spoke Absalike. That was the whole point. And I have also asked people who are from Crow, did this actually happen? And they won't deny that it happened, but they won't say it did happen either. So it's possible it did. I don't know. But the remedy is just go to the appellate court and get it reversed. And if you can't get it reversed from the appellate court, then that tribe definitely probably loses the right to prosecute cases against non-members. They shouldn't be. If that happened, it is a blatant violation of due process. There's a couple of things present about an amicus brief like that. Number one is designed to inflame the passions of the court. And the other is, you can do this in any amicus brief. You don't have to actually be reciting real facts. You can just make shit up in an amicus brief. You know, if 25 amicus briefs are filed in a Supreme Court case, or even 5, you think that anybody's going to do any fact-checking on those amicus briefs? The clerks don't know they know famous names, but they don't know what's right and what's wrong. They don't know what the facts are on the ground in any given tribe. None of them, until probably the last 10 years, no Supreme Court clerk had ever even taken Indian law in law school. So they take these facts, if they want to, as facts. They take these amicus briefs as a proper recitation of what goes on in Indian country. They assume that they are correct because the people who filed them are lawyers. I firmly believe the railroad companies are scum. Insurance companies are scum. Sorry, those of you who are going to end up working insurance defense, because that's a job and you should take it if you can get it. But it's like a scuzzy business. And there is no quality control whatsoever at the Supreme Court. One of the first questions asked of the tribe's attorney was, what happens when the jury consists entirely of the plaintiff's cousins? How are we supposed to take that court system seriously if that's the case? That was from Justice O'Connor at oral argument in the Strait. In the Strait case. I'm paraphrasing. You know, no Supreme Court judge would ever ask that question of a state or federal judge or federal jury. They would never ask that question. And the proper answer to that question is, you file an appeal and try to get that judge or that jury struck, and then redo the whole thing over again to comport with due process. And I don't think that was the answer that the tribe's attorney gave. I think Native American Rights Fund also argued the case. I just don't, you know, in the heat of the moment, you know, you can always second guess what happens at oral argument. But the fact that the court focused, I think, on an amicus brief, assumed that all tribes behaved as the Crow tribe did. They firmly did believe that all tribes behave that way, which is just overt racism, of course, and stereotyping and all sorts of terrible assumptions about things. Nobody made a claim that Judge Strait had done anything wrong at the tribal court level in this case, because really Judge Strait never had a chance. The case was immediately sent to federal court. And the court was so much in a hurry to shut down tribal jurisdiction, I think after reading this bullshit amicus brief, that they went to town on tribal courts generally. And that's why you have a 9-0 decision in a case that should have been the opposite. It should have been a great win for tribal jurisdiction for cases arising on trust land. That's my suspicion. There you go. Okay, questions. I see we have a couple here. Oh, I guess there's not a question. In any event, that's a straight case. It's an anomaly. But the court, Justice Ginsburg did explicitly say these rules apply on non-Indian land. So even though you might disagree with whether or not the state highway is non-Indian land, so long as we accept the proposition that we're still talking about non-Indian land, we're still in the universe of the original Montana case, it's really not that horrible. Any questions on Strait? Still pretty horrible, but it's not that horrible. Yeah. To be safe, I think you have to actually have to have a written document that explicitly says somebody, the non-members, is agreeing to tribal jurisdiction and to follow all tribal laws. And that's not that hard to do. I mean, the tribes have been doing that pretty consistently. The ones that want to. Not all tribes really care all that much, but most tribes that do, in a terrible circumstance, that's really easy. You just say, if you want to do business on this tribe, on this reservation, you've got to follow our rules. That's really easy to do. As a total, complete, unnecessary aside, I have to tell you a story about terror offices. So about 10 years ago or so, the Choctaw and Chickasaw Nations of Oklahoma brought suit against the state of Oklahoma and a bunch of people about water rights on that river that runs between Texas and Oklahoma. And it was in settlement negotiations for many years. And I was brought in to do an Indian Law 101 to people, business leaders in Oklahoma who just did not understand why these two tribes had hundreds of millions of dollars in cash on hand and the state of Oklahoma was functionally bankrupt. He just didn't understand Indian law at all. So I gave a little spiel about it. And while I was there, I met this guy named Harold Hamm, one of the Oklahoma business leaders. I don't know if you ever heard of Harold Hamm, but at that time, he was one of the 10 wealthiest men in the world. He was an oil and gas guy, made all his money in Oklahoma and Texas, and was really going to town with all the fracking stuff and just getting crazy rich. And he, at that time, was also Mitt Romney's energy advisor on when Romney was running for office. So he can kind of date when it was. My memory isn't great. In any event, so I met this guy. I had no idea who he was. He just said that he was, they told me it's Harold Hamm and he's rich from oil and gas. So he was talking to me and then I said, are you involved in any of the fracking stuff in North Dakota? And he said, a little bit North Dakota, but mostly Montana. And he was talking about how much money he was making in Montana. And then he said, he leaned into me and he said, the most corrupt public agency I've ever had to deal with is the Fort Peck Terror Agency. And I laughed because I used to work with tribes that had terror offices and the terror officials were, they're good people, but some of them were really dysfunctional. And so I kind of laughed and thought, yeah, that's probably true. And then he talked a little bit more about it. And I started to realize that he thought they were corrupt because the way a terror office works is you're a contractor, you go to the reservation and you want to bring your own employees along that you like, but you've got to get through the terror office. So let's say you have a list of 20 employees that you need to, if you're into oil and stuff, they're like, I don't know, what do you call those guys? I imagine they're like the Bruce Willis and Ben Affleck in that Armageddon movie. Those guys, right? They're highly skilled roughnecks, they're tough and they, all these great, crazy geology and engineering things, even though many of them probably didn't even graduate from high school or whatever. So I'm sure his company listed them all as completely unskilled workers to the Fort Peck Terror Office, who then said, well, if you have unskilled workers, you got to hire our people first. I'm pretty sure his roughnecks were not unskilled. They're probably making lots of money and much deservedly, but that's my imagination as to why he thought the Fort Peck Terror Agency was corrupt, and because he was corrupt in any event. Totally unrelated thing. We need to talk about that again. Oh, the tarot question is a very good one, Montana. I would also add that I think just under Montana 1 as a general rule, there's more than 900,000 people who work for tribal casinos. That's a lot of people. Not all of them. I'm sure the vast majority of those people, the casino employees, are not members of the tribe. And every time you go work for a tribe in both the enterprise side or in the government side, you probably consent in writing to an employee manual or handbook. And every time you do that, you're depending on how the handbook is written, you're probably consenting under Montana 1 to tribal jurisdiction, and rightfully so. So it's, the Montana 1 exception is actually a vast, in the words of my 11-year-old, a enormous exception, because literally hundreds of thousands of people have consented to tribal jurisdiction. And I haven't gotten to that point yet. You're starting to see how these cases are getting worse and worse. The fact patterns will become ridiculously bad as we go, because the only companies and people who do not consent to tribal jurisdiction are the very worst of the worst. And it started with hunting and fishing guys. I mean, they're just dudes who want to go hunting and fishing and be left alone. And they don't want to have to comply with state, federal, or tribal hunting licenses and regulations and that sort of thing. Now we're starting to see car wrecks, right? And the fact patterns get worse and worse. And the FMC case, which we'll talk about later today, you're talking about 22 million tons of radioactive and toxic waste being dumped on a tribe's reservation for literally decades. I got to stop saying literally. In any event, the fact patterns get worse and worse. And I think that's a function of the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. The same is true in criminal jurisdiction as well. They keep stripping away at tribal powers. And, you know, but at the same time that the tribes themselves are acquiring greater and greater capacity to govern. So the tribes are getting more ability to be sovereign, to exercise sovereignty, and bringing more and more people into their fold. But the ones that are fighting that and are successful in avoiding tribal jurisdiction tend to be the worst of the worst, what Malcolm Gladwell would have called the outliers. All right, any other questions about Strait? Okay, the next one is Nevada versus Hicks. And this is the case that really hit home in Indian country in a way that I think is probably overblown, but it's just another, in the mid to late 90s into 2001, it seemed like every time a tribe lost a case, it was 9-0 in the Supreme Court, and nobody could understand why. I mean, I can understand why, but only in hindsight. Nevada versus Hicks is about a guy named Floyd who lives on a reservation and he likes to hunt. And he's probably a poacher and he likes hunting and collecting bighorn sheep. And some of bighorn sheep are regulated as endangered species by federal, state, and tribal governments, and others are not. So the state of Nevada had been watching Floyd, who lived on trust property within, I think it's the Fallon Paiute tribe, I can't remember which one. In Nevada, they've been watching him and following him, and they thought that they caught him poaching endangered bighorn sheep off of the reservation. So they got a warrant from the state court to search his house. They went to the tribal court and got that warrant domesticated. The tribal court said, "Sure, you can come onto the reservation. We'll stamp your warrant. Go ahead. Make sure you bring a tribal police officer with you so there's no trouble." And they got there. They found nothing. They got into Floyd's house. They found some bighorn sheep materials, but they weren't the ones they were looking for. They weren't illegal ones, I guess. So they didn't find anything. Second time around, they went back. And I think they went back without talking to the tribal court first because I think Nevada conservation officers became convinced that somebody at the tribal court or maybe even tribal police was tipping Floyd off. So they got their warrant, just went straight to Floyd's house. They still didn't find anything, but they busted up a bunch of stuff. So Floyd brought a claim in tribal court against the state of Nevada and its conservation officers, its cops. In tribal court, they brought a claim under 42 U.S.C. section 1983, which is the federal civil rights statute that says you can bring a claim for money damages against state officials for violations of constitutional violations by federal law. And you can do so in federal court or you can do so in state court. And so that's Section 1983. It is a federal abrogation of state sovereign immunity in accordance with the 14th Amendment. It was enacted in, you know, the 1870s, late 1860s, early 1870s, right after the 14th Amendment. So you can bring a claim under 1983 in any court of general jurisdiction. So what that means is, just for your edification, state courts are courts of general jurisdiction. They can hear any tribal, they can hear any state or federal kind of claim within their jurisdiction. Federal courts, in contrast, under Article 3 of the Constitution, are courts of limited jurisdiction. So if you know anything about you remember this probably from civil procedure, or if you've taken a federal courts class, you'll know that you have to have federal subject matter jurisdiction or federal diversity jurisdiction in order to bring a claim in federal court. The argument that Floyd Hicks brought Section 1983 claim in tribal court was that the tribal court was also, like state courts, a court of general jurisdiction. In fact, the tribal court, the tribe, had adopted a tribal code that specifically stated the tribal court is a court of general jurisdiction. So they brought the 1983 claim. Nevada's motion to dismiss was rejected both at the trial and tribal appellate court levels. So the state went to federal court. They exhausted their tribal court remedies. And then they went, the Ninth Circuit said that tribal courts are indeed courts of general jurisdiction, and you can bring a Section 1983 claim against a tribe. And notably, the Ninth Circuit said, and by the way, this is on tribal trust property. So the way they read Nevada versus, Strait versus A1 Contractors is the way I just described it to you. So long as you're on tribal trust property, the tribe presumptively has jurisdiction. And the only real contested matter at the Ninth Circuit was whether Section 1983 was actually a claim that could be brought in tribal court. And I'm here to tell you right now, there's no way in hell a 1983 claim can be brought in tribal court. The only way that the federal government or Congress can abrogate state sovereign immunity is through one of those clear statement rules that I talked to you about before. And the Congress has to come right out and say, we are abrogating state sovereign immunity for this purpose. And that's what they did with Section 1983. You can bring a claim against state officials in federal or state court. Now, in 1870-odd or whatever, this 1983 was adopted, there were tribal courts in the U.S. Mostly they were in Oklahoma, the so-called five civilized tribes. But it's apparent from the legislative history of the statute 1983, which incidentally is also known as the Ku Klux Klan Act, they weren't talking about tribal courts. Congress was not considering tribal courts as a forum to sue state officials. So it doesn't pass the clear statement rule on state sovereign immunity. So the Ninth Circuit just got that wrong. You can't bring a claim in tribal court against state officials. All that hullabaloo about courts of general jurisdiction is very cute, but that's not how sovereign immunity works. And to be fair to the Ninth Circuit, they were writing that opinion at a time when the state sovereign immunity jurisprudence was still a little bit in flux, generally speaking, at the Supreme Court level. You know, the 11th Amendment, nobody really knew what that meant until 1996 in Florida, Seminole Tribe of Florida versus Florida. We didn't know what it meant under state jurisdiction until Alden versus Maine, which was decided the same term as Nevada versus Hicks in 2001. So there was some, it wasn't like the Ninth Circuit, you know, shat the bed or anything. It was just that things were up in the air. But now that we know about those other 11th Amendment type cases, when it comes to state sovereign immunity, you cannot bring a claim under Section 1983 in tribal court. But the Ninth Circuit ruled in favor of Floyd Hicks. That's why you have Nevada versus Hicks. And the Ninth Circuit spent a lot of time talking about the Montana test and how it didn't apply, or if it did apply, it applied in only a very minimal matter, a limited matter on cases that arise on tribal trust land. And it was a little bit of the fact that it was the state of Nevada's policing authority, law enforcement authority at issue, created a little bit of a perfect storm that led to the Hicks decision. So you had the Ninth Circuit spouting off about how the Supreme Court is screwing everything up on cases like Strait versus A1. And whenever you tell the Supreme Court they're wrong about something, they really like telling you to go fuck yourself. You also have this whole issue of Section 1983 and state sovereign immunity, in addition to the fact that it is the state trying to enforce state law, criminal law in Indian country. Those three factors guaranteed that Floyd Hicks was going to lose at the Supreme Court and lose badly. In fact, I think it was 8-1. I think Justice Stevens at least dissented and said that tribal courts are courts of general jurisdiction and bought the Ninth Circuit's theory, in part because of what RBG had written in the Strait case, that on tribal trust property, at least implicitly, and even through Strait, tribes have presumptive jurisdiction. But so you have an opinion in Hicks where Scalia goes off on how people used to go to Indian country to hide out from state law enforcement because of the poorly decided Worcester case, and that Indian country is lawless and it's a good place to, Bonnie and Clyde used to go to Indian country to hide out. The Dalton gang used to go to Indian country and hide out. All this stuff is, it's not in the opinion, but it's all part of the mythology of what Indian country is. It's some sort of lawless enclave of criminals and Indians. And then you have the long, lengthy discourse about how the Montana case is one of the greatest and most important Supreme Court decisions ever issued in relation to Indian affairs. And then it definitely applies even on tribal trust property, which sparked a concurring opinion from RBG saying, yeah, you're right. The tribes can't, you can't sue under 1983 in tribal court, but you're wrong about what I wrote in the Strait case. The Montana test doesn't apply for cases arising in trust property. But again, there's just one lonely, regretful concurring opinion for somebody who wrote a terrible opinion. And then later on, when it's construed logically to make things worse, sort of like, oh, I didn't really mean it when I said it. And then you also have a whole round of concurrences, particularly the concurrence from Justice Souter, who wrote a lengthy law review article basically saying tribal courts are really awful places to be if you're white. They're unfair. Everything's in the language. They're informal. You can't find tribal laws online anywhere. Nobody actually was looking for anything online. I'm sure the guy never even had an email address. Citing to all these Indian people talking about how tribes are trying to do things like circle sentencing and peacemaking. And he's like, what the fuck is that? Just a terrible concurring opinion that is virulently racist. All at the same time, trying to say that it's because tribes are not faithful to due process that we love at the Supreme Court. And I think within a short period of time, Souter personally would have said, I would have apologized for writing that opinion. But he did it. And it's cited to this day as justification for the proposition that tribal courts are illiberal, informal courts that are kangaroo courts where non-Indians cannot get justice. And then you have Justice O'Connor's opinion. I strongly suspect Justice O'Connor was actually asked to write the opinion originally in the Hicks case, because it reads like a majority opinion. And all it says is Section 1983 does not abrogate the 11th Amendment immunity of tribes. That's the way this case should have come down. And in a narrow way, that's all this case really says. But because the Ninth Circuit went out of its way to attack the court's jurisprudence, particularly the Strait and Montana cases, the case reads as if this is a straight up tribal civil jurisdiction case. Floyd Hicks is a crook, and the state of Nevada should be authorized to go wherever it wants to raid Indian country as it sees fit in order to prosecute Indians who commit violations of state law and then go to Indian country to hide out. So in a lot of ways, it's a particularly awful opinion. For whatever reason, Justice Stevens dissented, and his opinion is very pro-tribal, but in a way that's a little bit, even I'm, skeptical of. I mean, you don't necessarily think that tribal courts are places you can bring claims against state officials when you probably should go to state or federal court to do it. I mean, it's not going to be the end of the world to go to tribal court, but it is. I can see it's consistent with the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on the 11th Amendment. In any event, that's Nevada versus Hicks. It's the one time the court has said that the Montana test applies to Indian cases arising on Indian lands, and I think it's overbroad. They didn't have to say that. They absolutely did not have to say that. And I don't think it's really accurate to say that the Montana test applies on Indian lands. It makes no sense. It does apply. You can apply it, or you can just say that when it's a state or federal official engaging in acts on Indian lands, then yeah, then you would have a restriction on tribal jurisdiction. That presumption in favor of tribal authority over non-members goes away when it's actually a state or federal law enforcement official, or any official, really. And I think that's a fair assessment of what the Hicks case really stands for. But to say that the Montana test applies to all cases that arise on tribal trust land, I think is absolutely wrong. There is a Ninth Circuit case called Waterwheel that has been kicking around now for close to 10 years, which explains very persuasively why the Montana test cannot apply on Indian lands. And the reason that's the case is that on Indian lands, an Indian tribe can exclude anyone it wants from those lands. And like any property owner could. If you came into my house right now and made a stink, I could make you leave. I mean, I probably would have to call the cops if you're bigger and tougher than I am. But when you come into my house as a property owner, I could make you leave the house. And the same is true for Indian reservations. If you go to Indian country, the tribe has the power to exclude you. That's the Marion case. And I could also say, as a property owner, as tribes often do, that if you do come onto our lands, you have to consent to tribal jurisdiction. So the Montana test is irrelevant in that context. Either you are kicked out, or as under Marion, as through the power of exclusion, or you've agreed under Montana 1, effectively, and the Marion case, to tribal jurisdiction as a condition of entrance onto the property. So it doesn't, and that would not be the case with state or federal officials, agreed, more or less, subject to the Fourth Amendment or whatever. But as a general matter, the application of the Montana rule on Indian lands actually makes no sense whatsoever. The only way it makes sense is if you strip the tribe of its power of exclusion. And I just don't see the Supreme Court doing that. I mean, actually, I see them doing it. They haven't done it yet. Marion is still good law. All right, any questions on straight? Yeah. If they are, if the cross-deputization agreement authorizes it, yeah. But it would have to do that. And otherwise, no, I don't see that as a possibility. And you can point to Hicks as justification for that. That's something, it depends on how much bargaining power the tribe has. And right now, vis-a-vis most, nearly all state and local governments, tribes don't have the bargaining power to subject state officials cross-deputized to enforce tribal law to be subject to tribal court jurisdiction. I don't see that as a possibility at the moment, but, you know, in the future, I could absolutely see it. You know, look at Muscogee Creek Reservation itself. The only functioning, effective, and efficient government on Muscogee is the Muscogee tribe. Oklahoma has, as a functioning state, is not really functionable. I mean, it's bankrupt. And, you know, the local governments don't, they're poor, they don't collect much taxes, they don't have tax revenue, they're ineffective governments. This is part of the briefing in the McGirt and Murphy cases, is how, you know, Oklahoma and local units of government have effectively vacated, at least on civil regulatory side, governance of that reservation. Muscogee is the only one that's really doing anything. They operate hospitals, they patrol the whole reservation with police, and, you know, public safety and ambulances and all that stuff that the state government, local governments do not do anymore because they don't have the resources or capacity to do it. In that context, you can see how if the tribe's doing all the work and the local government says, well, we want to send our police out and enforce tribal law, then the tribe would say, you have to comply with our rules then. And I could see that in that context. But as a general matter, it doesn't happen very often. Any other questions? Okay, let's take five. Quick break.